Hey guys, this is Colin from Blackjack Apprenticeship, and I'm joined right now with Andrew Yule, author of The Blackjack Insiders, How Two Pit Bosses Beat the Casinos at Their Own Games. I just got an early copy of the book. I know it's out now, but I read it ahead of time, read it in like 2 or 3 days, and I'm excited to talk about the book. And I know Andrew is excited to have his book on bookshelves. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing great, Colin. Yeah, thanks for having me. I am excited for sure.
Awesome. Awesome. When did the book come out?
The official release date is today. So,
Nice. Hey, congratulations.
Here, so they've been shipping already, but the official release date is today. So.
Oh, awesome. Congratulations, and may many books fly off the shelves.
Fingers crossed. Yeah, thank you.
So the book was interesting to me because it's really this kind of behind the scenes, you know, it's like there's the kind of dual life aspect, but there's really for those of us that are on the advantage play side of things, it's very rare that we get a peek into the other side of the game. But when you first got into the casino industry, what was your opinion of advantage players?
That's a great question. You know, I didn't have a lot of insight into it. I tried to do some reading on it before I was even in the business. But I didn't have enough experience in anything to really understand it. And we didn't really have that many or that much experience with them when I started. So I guess I was kind of ignorant to it all.
Uh-huh. And how did you even get into the casino industry?
Well, I was in construction in 2007, which was the worst time to be in construction pretty much anywhere in the country.
Yeah, seriously.
And after some unemployment, I saw an ad in the paper for an entry-level pit clerk position at a casino for $11 an hour, and took that and rolled it into dealing, rolled it into supervising, rolled it into managing, and it just kind of never turned back.
So, where along that path did you really start to learn about advantage play?
Right about the time, probably right about the time where we took that basic strategy test. You know, we talk about it in the book.
Okay.
How Mark kind of saw a little bit of potential in the basic strategy test. I had just become a supervisor just recently, and we started talking a little bit about the possibilities of advantage play and, you know, how to watch for it and things like that.
Cool. So for those who haven't read the book, you work with a guy named Mark, and that's how you actually got into learning card counting. How long do you think that training took?
I want to say a few months. I was pretty enthusiastic about it. You know, studying the basic strategy, running through decks, flipping through cards. We had
a couple of really good practice sessions in the shift manager's office, which is probably part of the book that I love. You know, I was learning how to count cards in the manager's office, doing practice sessions in there. But I want to say 3-4 months of really solid practice before I tried anything in the casino.
Okay. And, I love the story you tell about dropping the count during your first, it seems like it's your first in casino play with Mark. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, at Sunset Station.
Like you go to the bathroom. Yeah. You go to the bathroom, you know, frustrated with yourself that you lost the count. He's like, oh, it was 4. Like, don't worry about it. Keep going. It's like just so relatable to anyone who's, you know.
Yeah. You get that. I remember being kind of hot in the forehead, you know, a little frustrated, a little embarrassed. And it's frustrating, you know. But you know that you can't really afford to stay there and try to guess what it is or make any mistakes like that. So you just kind of have to regroup and get yourself back together.
And from the beginning of kind of in casino play, how long was that transition before you were, you know, approved to be on your own playing?
After that session. So my first in casino play was a test run. And when the test run went well, he handed me $500 and kind of said, just go run amok. I'm leaving. I'll catch up with you later.
Awesome.
So I worked under his bankroll that way for only a month. And then we decided to make it into something a little bigger.
I'll let people read the story for themselves to see how, you know, the bankroll progresses and all that stuff. But not surprisingly, most of my questions center around the casino side of things. You know, it's just so interesting and helpful to hear that side. And I know you're not going to give any, intel of what places in Vegas to hit or anything like that. But I've got some questions I think it would be really interesting to my audience. So can you talk a little bit about casinos thinking superstitiously or not thinking in terms of EV?
Yeah, for sure. I could probably talk for a couple episodes about that. The casinos share a lot of superstitions that the players share, about hot dealers and don't deal so many hands and cut this in half. And, there's a lot of superstitions out there. And I don't want to generalize the casinos, but it's certain employees inside the casinos have this view. And it does tend to be a lot of them, unfortunately. But,
or fortunately for the card counters.
Yeah, fortunately for the card counters. It doesn't always work out that way. I remember one particular boss sending me the slowest dealer he could possibly send because that was his ace in the hole. I heard him say that to his counterpart. That dealer was his ace in the hole, and I was getting 40 hands an hour out of this guy. I had to leave the table.
Yeah, man. Dude, casino, that I tell people, the one thing that you can rely on with casinos is that you can't, they're completely inconsistent. We've had casinos send in really their fastest dealer to counteract card counters. We had them send in their slowest dealer. We've had them change dealers every couple of hands, to change up the flow of the cards or something. But in 2000, what's that?
Changing the flow of the cards. I love that's one of my favorite superstitions.
Yeah. So in 2019, this is still prevalent?
Absolutely.
Yes. I love
it. Too much, yeah, for sure.
Oh, that is so funny to me. Awesome.
Not just the superstitions, but there's a misconception out there that the dealers and that the staff and everybody knows the game really well and can spot things. But that's, there's a lack of that out there too. Most of the dealers, most of the floors don't know basic strategy to a T. They wouldn't be able to tell you the right move to make on most given plays.
Yeah. Man, I was just playing last weekend. And the pit boss and dealer were giving me a hard time because I wasn't playing consistently,
Right.
One time I'd hit a 16 against a 10, another time I wouldn't, you got to be consistent. That's your problem.
You have to always hit it or never hit it, right? I hear that every day of my life at the casino. Always hit it or never hit it.
and the number of dealers I've heard that tell me, well, I've been dealing a long time. I know the flow of the cards. It just kills me.
I heard it when I was playing. I hear it when I'm working. I know exactly what you're talking about. The dealers think they know, and the players that have played a lot think they know too.
So my next question for you, you talk about going south with chips, and I'm assuming that's rat holing.
Yeah, same thing.
And do you recommend card counters, or how would you recommend card counters go about this?
Well, I did a post on Gambling with an Edge about this, a whole dive into it. I don't know that I would recommend it, but I did it myself. But you have to kind of be careful about the way that you do it. If you're going to take black off the table, make sure there's other people at the table playing black. Whatever color you want to take off, there has to be other people at the table that have that in action, or they're just going to know that it's you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I still think even if there's not, it can be beneficial just to avoid the chips piling up in front of you, attracting some attention. But you don't want to take too much off because then, they're looking, they're like, holy crap, there's 2,500 in black missing. Where did that all go? Then they're keeping an extra eye on you.
It kind of seems like weighing the pros and cons of just having a, like you said, a huge pile of chips growing in front of you, versus them, being suspicious. We had a guy get backed off from a casino. I think he was up $60,000 and they backed him off because he was rat holing. They said, we're backing you off for like the month because of suspicious activity. And they had no idea he was counting cards. It was just,
that's a great story.
You know,
I love
it. Yeah. I could tell you the casino and the name of the player, but I won't. But it was like, really? You got backed off for, you know, he was just stuffing all his $500 chips in his pockets because he just had so many. And they're like, we don't, you know, you're done for the month is what they said.
I would like to say you also modern supervisors don't care about that kind of stuff, but I can't say it with complete confidence because of stories like that, you know, not all supervisors are modern supervisors. So upset some people. It shouldn't really, but it's upsetting to some supervisors out there. To that,
I can't say that this
is funny.
Yeah. I can't say it was a modern casino. This was like one of those out in the middle of nowhere places that he was just, you know, they were letting him play and he didn't know what to do with all these $500 chips.
I'm surprised they had them at a place like that. Sometimes they
don't. Well, this was a place, we actually won $500,000 there in the course of a year. And what they told us while they were letting everybody on the team play is, we're not worried about table games because we're making so much money off slot machines. But then once we hit 500K, they change their tune.
That's funny. That's basically like them inviting you to play, right? They can't get any better than that.
Yep. Okay. So you also talk about that's a good idea not to be around during the shift change. What if you've been losing? Is that good for one shift to tell the next, hey, this guy's down, you know, $10,000 or whatever?
It could be, but then you're relying totally on the information that he passes over. You know, he might be passing over stuff about rat holing. He might, anything that he passes over could catch the eye or the ear of this incoming floor. If he passes strictly that information that you're down 2,500, then great. But if he passes on any information about your betting pattern or your, you know, how you like to play or one crazy move that you made, you know, any small detail like that could catch the eye or the ear of the incoming floor, and it's tricky for sure.
So I would imagine when the new shift comes on, that's when they're going to be most suspicious of you. Is like, okay, who's this guy? What's he doing? What, you know? Or is that not the case?
No, it is. Especially if you're on a run. You know, if you got some big bets out there, they're going to come right in and be like, oh, who's this guy? And come over and look at pull you up on the screen, maybe go check you out on the computer. You don't want to catch their eye right when they're coming in.
So depending on what you're betting, I would think they probably have some notes on you anyway, or is that not true?
It's possible. It depends on your history at that casino. If you're somebody that's been around a lot, or you're regular. Myself, I frequented a lot of the same casinos when I was playing in Vegas and, you know, some of the other places we visited. So that's possible. There could be other notes in there. Not something you want them to go to the screen and check out, because they usually will do that as they're coming in. You know, they'll go around and just kind of check all their racks, check on all their players. It's one of the only times a night where you can count on them being somewhat diligent about checking on everything.
Mm. You also talk about most casinos have a procedure for deck penetration. What does that actually look like? Because all I know is like this, you know, from the player side of the table, and that some of them have notches. Other casinos, it's like, it's kind. This place seems to cut off 1.75. This casino seems to cut off 1.25. But how do they communicate a procedure from the casino side?
It depends on the type of game. If you're looking at a 6 or 8 deck shoe game, it'll look like approximately one deck or approximately a deck and a half, something like that. If you're looking at a double deck game, it'll say 25 cards, 40 cards, you know, whatever the case may be. If single deck, there's usually a hand rule, like the rule of seven.
Mm-hmm.
The players plus the number of hands has to equal seven. Yeah, it just depends on the game type.
Okay. So with the rule of seven, if there's three players, then they would do what?
Four.
Two. What's that?
Four hands.
Oh, four rounds. Okay. And if there's one player, they'll do six rounds?
Six rounds, supposedly. Some.
Got it.
Some casinos use a rule of six and some will use a rule of seven. I've seen seven the most. But I haven't played a lot of
six. I want to
hit it in Wendover.
So. Okay. I want to find out about the casinos with the rule of 10.
Yeah, that's great. If you find that, let me know. We're going
to sounds good. Let's put a little side bankroll together. You also mentioned Biometrica. Wearing a hat throw it off, or you know, any like best advice?
It doesn't. You know, I'm in Biometrica. I wear a lot of hats. There's a lot of cameras in the casino. If they want to get the right picture of you, they're probably going to get it. You know, wearing a hat or trying to wear sunglasses or stuff like that. It's not. Most of the great players I know wear hats all the time, and they're some of the most well-known players that are out there. So does it help? Maybe a little bit. Does it prevent? No, it doesn't prevent anything.
Could you just talk to them not being able to stop looking at you when they're on the phone with surveillance or a manager?
Well,
I hope this answers
your question, but so the idea is to go on your run, win or lose, and be gone by the time that the supervisor has called surveillance to say this guy is doing this, this guy's doing that. You know, he's betting a lot of money, because they probably will call once you get up to, you know, betting a few hundred dollars. They're going to call on you in most places. That's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is by the time surveillance gets that call and looks at you, to be gone. You don't want to be there for them to talk to you, because they'll just, oh, that's this guy. And then the shift manager comes down and you get that familiar tap on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can be gone by the time that happens, that's ideal.
Okay. Is this primarily in Vegas? Cause you know, I don't know. I guess outside of Vegas, I just play through the heat.
I did a lot too. It depends on the casino. A lot of the smaller places don't have Biometrica. They might have the database, but they don't have the software, facial recognition mm-hmm. software. But if you're talking about like those big Indian casinos, like the ones in Southern California and in the Midwest and stuff, I would equate those on the same level as a lot of the strip casinos. But you know,
any other
card rooms in Seattle and card rooms in California and elsewhere, you know, I definitely play through the heat there down in the South too. I would play through most of that stuff too.
Yeah. I mean, I just played 3 days, some like 27 hours, at a large tribal casino, and just played through the heat. And, leaving by the time they made a phone call, like I'd spend more time driving than playing. So I just went for it and, you know, worked out okay. But I understand in Vegas, it's just like, man, the heat can come down pretty quick.
It sure can. I have an extra edge when it comes to detecting the heat, right? I know what they're doing and the phone calls they're making and what they're looking at most of the time. And I still got a lot of those taps on the shoulder. So most of them came from Vegas. So yeah, the heat definitely comes faster in Vegas for sure.
Any other just telltale signs of heat, especially in Vegas?
Anytime they come over and look at the monitor and then go right back to the phone, for sure. I mean, that's pepper. That's one that most of us probably have seen and recognized by now. If they're on the phone and make eye contact with you, most supervisors can't talk about a player on the phone without looking at them for some reason. I don't know why, but
yeah,
that's a good one.
So another quote, you said, it becomes apparent to me that no one on property had the authority to make the call to back me off. The real bosses must have been on their days off. How common is that? What's that?
Laughlin. Laughlin, I remember that.
Yeah.
The Edgewater, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. If you play kind of early in the week, you know, almost any casino in the world, their big bosses are off Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, something like that.
Nice.
That's just the way it is most places.
That's awesome. I actually, this is a weird story, but I was playing in another country not that long ago. I was actually on vacation, but found, you know, this little casino, and I didn't have much money, but I had a few $1,000 and I was able to withdraw $1,000 a day from the ATM. So I was just like playing it, you know, hoping to have more positive variance than negative, but I wasn't. I was losing, and so I was trying to see if they would comp mine and my wife's stay at this resort, and they kept putting me off. And then they finally said, well, the casino manager isn't back until Monday. And it was like Friday. So they basically told me they had no one really that knew what they were doing all weekend.
Or no one with the authority to do it, at least. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, yeah.
In smaller towns, smaller places, for sure. You know, there's nobody that can make that call if the boss isn't around. In the bigger places, you know, another department or there's somebody around that can do it.
So you share a story of a casino in the South where they wanted to back room you and you kind of, you know, clarified, are you really saying you want to do this? And, you know, kind of got out of it. Any pro tips from, you know, you understanding the casino side on avoiding, you know, a back room?
Nothing that I've learned from being on the casino side. That's just stuff that I knew from talking and reading forums. And, I guess I had heard maybe from a security officer that where I used to work, that they're not allowed to touch you and that they're not allowed to keep you there against your will if you haven't done anything illegal. So these guys, as much as they were trying to do that, you know, I just tried to clarify, like, are you saying that I have to stay here? Are you saying that I can't leave? Just, you know, anytime you're under pressure like that, just make them state their intentions.
Yep. That's awesome. I mean, I've told the story before and I wrote in my book about later in my career when I knew better and the guy's like trying to get me to go to the back room. I'm staying where everyone can see me, where there's cameras and old ladies at slot machines and saying, no, thank you. I would like to leave. I'd like to cash out and leave. And, you know, basically by not giving them any leverage, you know, they finally like came to their senses and cashed me out and I left. But, for those listening that haven't heard this stuff before, just don't let them intimidate you. Don't put your hands up. Don't do anything that could look like you're being aggressive. Just simply stay in a public place and say, I would like to leave, hands at your side, walk to the front door. And, you know, if they physically detain you, call Bobner Session and get yourself a nice six-figure settlement.
That's great. I do tend to keep my hands up just in the palms out non-threatening position, you know, just to make so the cameras can see my hands and make sure that, you know, that's the only thing I would say about that. But yeah, for sure. Don't let them intimidate you. The law's on your side. They can't hold you. They can't keep you there. I've had similar experiences where they're just following me around, trying to get me to go with them. And I didn't know where the cage was, so I'm just walking aimlessly, hoping to run into a cage so I can just get my money and get out of there.
Yeah, we did not want it to look like if your hands were up, like even if they walk into you, it could look like you pushed them, you know, or anything like that. You want to be really clear, but I like the palms up. That's it's pretty clear. So one of our, I mentioned this to you before I started recording, but I asked on our forum, you know, what questions people had for you. And one of them was, this person wants to know what on earth happened to the Oasis. Now it's just like a parking garage and some offices. Yeah. Do you have any intel on that?
Just from being a resident of Mesquite, I wouldn't call it inside intel or anything, but it, Black Gaming, as it used to be called, got to the point where they needed to close down one casino and the Oasis, revenue generating though it was the most expensive to keep up. The ceilings were falling in, you know. It was just an old building from being Cy Red's Pepper Mill back in the day. I think it was even something before that, Western Village or something. It's been there for a long, long time. And it was a fun place. It was kind of the hot place in town to be, but they just couldn't afford to keep it standing anymore. They did tear it down, but they probably didn't have to. It would have fallen over on its own.
That's funny. Too risky and too expensive to maintain something that bad of shape.
Parts of ceiling were like falling into the casino. I mean, it was...
There should be some jackpot if ceiling tiles fall on you.
Yeah,
you
know, the legal jackpot.
You're the big winner. Okay, so our next question from the forum is in... your mind, how suspicious is back counting, not to you, but to the pit in general?
Not very.
Yes, great answer. You're just watching the game is all it looks like, right?
And most of the time, you know, they're not thinking about stuff like that. They're thinking about, oh, I got to swipe in this rating card. I got to, you know, count these chips. I got to go make this comp. You know, there's somebody standing behind a table. You know, by the time you find a good count, sit down and fire at it, you know, they might not even remember that you were the guy that was standing there watching the table.
I want to take a quick moment and talk about the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership. If you haven't checked it out, you really don't know what you're missing. There is everything you need to train, find community, and get the tools you need as a card counter. There's a test out drill in the training suite, and if you aren't testing your skills regularly, you really shouldn't be playing a casino. There's an entire video course that covers the basics all the way to more advanced stuff like cover, team play, casino relations. There's betting software, a forum, a chat room with regional chat rooms to meet with local APs, as well as results tracking software and members only podcasts. So check it out at blackjackapprenticeship.com. Awesome. Awesome. Love it.
That's a great question.
I'll let the forum person know. So our next forum question is, what percentage of card counters that you've backed off were identified by surveillance versus the pit?
Every card counter I've personally backed off has been one that I personally identified.
Okay. What, you might be unique in this because you're knowledgeable about advantage play. Right. What do you think is the most common, surveillance or pit?
Surveillance, for sure.
Okay. Cool. And just how much are they watching for it?
I wouldn't say that they're watching for it. They're not running down just random decks and stuff. They've got a lot of stuff they're worrying about up there. And there's just those identifiers that catch their eye, you know, a big bet spread or a goofy move or something like that that'll catch their eye there, but they're not up there, you know, on card counter watch, just like the floors, you know.
Yeah.
We talked about the floors, you know, they're worrying about so many other things, and surveillance is even more than that. They're looking for, you know, undesirable people. They're looking for people on the slots. They're looking for all kinds of different things.
So that card counter that doesn't buy insurance at a true three isn't, you know, just throwing surveillance off his scent.
No. Index numbers rarely throw surveillance off, I would say.
All right. So if people don't believe me, maybe they'll believe you.
I mean, I hope so. Index plays, if anything, if you stick to the way that you're supposed to play, that throws them off because they don't know about index plays.
So I love the story about Ken's advantage play being the comps. You know, I've known a few APs, you know, that really their move was milking the comps. What kind of stakes do you think a player needs to really make that worth their time?
On tables? Because on slots, it's you know, almost nothing. But yeah, on tables,
yeah,
green chips at least.
Yeah, that's what I would have thought. And even then, green chips, it's probably not going to be really that worth your time unless you just really enjoy it.
Yeah, depending on the house, yeah. I mean, I was talking about Ken, and we were in Mesquite. The comps are a little more generous there. The floors had more authority to write the comps than they do now. You know, this was years ago, so it takes at least, I would say, a $50 bet in an average casino to get any sort of leverage with comps.
But if you've got the bankroll, you can be betting green or black action, and just like a small enough bet spread to make it a break even or positive EV game, slow the game down, and then get the value out of the comps. That was kind of Mark's strategy. Ken's strategy.
Yeah, he would make the card changes take forever. You know, he'd talk to the dealers and get all the players involved. What should I do? What should I do? Let's take a vote, you know. I mean, all these different, anything he could do to slow the game down. He'd move around a lot. He'd go, you know, I'll be right back, and leave his chips on the table so the rating stays open and be gone for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
There's a whole book about stuff like that, Comp City.
Yeah.
That's a great for these kinds of tactics. Max Rubin, right?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, people do it. I've always been a go after the money kind of guy, but if you enjoy the comps, you know, it can be done.
Yeah, me too. I mean, you and I are pretty similar in our philosophies, I think. I was a go-for-the-money guy. I didn't want to waste any time either, but that's what was part of just the funny stuff about being involved with Ken was how different our philosophies were and how different our strategies were, and that made our relationship a little bit more interesting sometimes, you know, getting in play arguments about which way was better, and you guys spend too much money and you mess around too much, you know.
Well, he's got a, you know, a meal at a casino, and I've got the money. So guess it depends what you want more.
Yeah, exactly. Ken had a really good job, so he didn't to be gambling for money like I did at that point in my life.
Yeah.
He was an older guy too. He was in his retirement stage of blackjack, I would say.
Well, there's something just fun about beating the game, and that was his way of beating the game, and the money wasn't the reward.
And
I get that.
He knew that he was better than the game, and he knew that he probably could make more money, but he didn't want to end up getting backed off, and this was his way to keep his longevity and being able to keep vacationing there and getting his massages that he wanted to get, and basically get everything he wanted for free. It's not such a bad thing. Good for him.
I had a guy at a boot camp once that he said he wanted me to give him a break-even bet spread, like not positive EV, just break-even. And I was like, well, how much are you willing to lose? He said, well, if I lost $1 million, I'd have to slow down. And I said, well, all right, here's a break-even bet spread, you know, $1 million bankroll. And he just wanted to know that he wasn't playing a losing game and he wanted the comps. He was like a retired pharmaceuticals guy that had, you know, more money than he knew what to do with. And the thought of, you know, not playing a losing game, getting the comps was what he wanted. So I guess making, you know, 100, 200 bucks an hour at the tables is uninteresting if you're at that stage in your life.
It's funny the way that advantage players, you know, we think about stuff like that. My opinion is, in reality, it wouldn't make a difference if he was breaking even or making $200 at the table. The evaluation process to me would be the same. I don't think he would get backed off if he was making $200 an hour.
Yeah.
With a bankroll that size. That's just kind of the way that we read into things like that more than we have to.
Yep. Yeah. So our next question is, in chapter 16, the seventh circle of hell, Andrew and Mark suffer a huge downswing. The person said, I really like how this was written because as a newbie, I'm trying to prepare for these kinds of losses. So what he wants to know is kind of what level of risk were you guys playing at?
1%, even less than 1%.
1%. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
What was the rest of the question? Just how to prepare for losses like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the point is, even with 1% risk of ruin, that's 1% of losing your entire bankroll.
Yeah, that's one chance.
They're still going to be, yeah.
Sounds like such a number, but it's, you know, it's totally possible. 1% chances happen all the time.
And even aside from losing the entire bankroll, that's not saying you won't have losing streaks, you know? It'd be nice if it was 1% chance of a horrific losing streak, but it's not. It's
1% of losing everything. There's twice as much chance that you lose almost everything.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, talk a little bit about just battling back.
It was that losing streak that I went through was one of the toughest things I ever had to deal with. And I've been divorced.
I wouldn't wish it on anybody. You just have to trust that you're better than the game. You just put in your hours. Just like if the casino takes a big hit from one guy, they shouldn't anyway close the table. You just have to keep it open, keep your table open, keep playing. Don't vary from your strategy. The strategy is the way it is for a reason, and you just have to trust that it's going to come out in the end. And I'm not going to lie and say it's easy. It's difficult. I had a lot of phone calls with Mark and a lot of sitting staring at a blank wall, you know, wondering whether I'm really better than this game or whether maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. But if you put the time in,
yes,
your system's proven, you know, you just have to trust it.
Yeah. Well, I've got another couple of quotes that are on the same idea. One of them is probably, you know, one of my favorite quotes from the book. You said, this was what a partner is supposed to do. He was lifting me up when morale was low, keeping me focused on the task at hand, while at the same time making sure I was accountable to him for putting in the time and effort to turn the situation around. I was reaping one of the major benefits of having a partner as opposed to playing on my own. There was a mutual support system, and it was exactly what I needed. I think anyone that's played blackjack for any length of time can relate to that quote of, you know, here's my question for you is, did you have any other support system outside of Mark during this?
My parents, they were the only ones that knew any details. I mean, a lot of people knew what I was doing, but nobody knew amounts and nobody got the kind of phone calls that Mark and my parents got. You know, your parents are a different kind of support system. My parents were anyway, you know, cause they didn't know the game. It's different from, when I call my mom, she's like, Oh my God. You know, that sounds good. what are you going to do? But when you call Mark, it's like, just, you got to keep playing. You're better than this. You can do this. But outside of that, I was kind of on an island with the with the rest of the world. I didn't know really any other Advantage players. I didn't. We weren't connected with anybody. It was just kind of him and I. That team thing is pretty incredible. There's no way I could have been able to handle some of the losing streaks that I handled without him. I remember specifically there was when we were in Mississippi. We were in a hotel in Ocean Springs, and I remember I lost like something like 9 or 10,000 that day, which was a huge, you know, with our structure was a huge number for a single day. And he, had a opposite. He had won something like 11,000 and he said, just remember, we're still up. And I go, no, you're up. I got my kicked. He goes, no, we're up. We're a team. And that just totally, that was a really defining moment for me and the whole team state of mind.
Yeah, that's awesome. To have a partner that's, you know, not gonna kind of, you know, have ego involved of like, well, why are you losing? I'm winning. I remember the opposite once. I played like an all night session at a casino, and at the end of it, I was up like $20,000, and I was ecstatic because we'd been on a losing streak. And I call my teammate to be like, dude, you know, I'm up 20 grand. And he's like, hey, way to go. Just so you know, I lost 30,000 last night. And it was like, it was initially defeating, but I was like, hey, you know what? I'm glad I won because it's a lot easier to stomach his $30,000 loss with my $20,000 win. He was, for those wondering, he was playing a different Advantage play that had a lot more variance. And so, you know, it was hard to stomach, but having that support system, it's just so necessary, you know, otherwise you get stuck in your own head. I like this quote too. You said, I got so competitive that the feeling of losing ate at my pride. Having a partner to bring me back to reality was helpful beyond explanation.
Oh, for sure. Cause it, you know, you do get competitive cause you know, you're better than the game. And when the game's beating you, it's tough to stomach, you know, you get really like angry sometimes, or you shouldn't, but it's you know, it's just human nature.
Without, I mean, angry just or
remind you of where you are and why you're there, it's sometimes it can get out of control.
Yeah, I mean, getting angry or feeling ashamed, you know, like I don't like, it's so hard to tell other people, hey, I'm losing, you know, because we're in there to beat the game. It can be just like a huge hit to the ego to say, you know, I don't want people knowing when I'm on a losing streak. But it also provides that opportunity for the support system to say, look, you know, happens to the best of us, keep grinding.
And I always thought it was funny, like the difference between Advantage players and regular gamblers when they're losing, because regular gamblers want to keep buying in and keep chasing and they want to bet more money. And I remember, you know, when I was on my losing streaks, I just wanted to go sit at home and stare at the ceiling. Like I didn't, you know, I was almost afraid to play at one point, you know, when it got so bad. So I always found that interesting, the mentalities different, you know, between gamblers and players like us.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So after chapter 16 is followed up with chapter 17, call it a comeback, and you mentioned picking apart pit after pit. And you said, we exploited weaknesses and shift changes in staff rotation. Can you allude to any of those weaknesses?
Just, you know, when we would normally play in the beginning, we would go eat at a shift change or something and be back. This time we just kind of took it to another level. We were only there for a short amount of time, so we would just disappear long enough for them to turn over their information and then come right back. And then we tended not to worry about the surveillance shift change so much, but we did this time. You know, we were trying to stay off everybody's radar, so we disappear again for just a few minutes while the our perceived surveillance shift change, which is different from the pit. So just kind of trying to cut every corner we could cut without exposing ourselves.
So trying to avoid shift change was one of your guys' big strategies to stay off their, you know, their radar.
Especially when we played together, because, you know.
Oh, okay.
When him and I were in the same building, you know, we took extra measures like that. I wouldn't say that on a normal playing session, me just walking into a casino, I would really worry about the shift change too much. Depending on what kind of run I was in and what I had in front of me. But when we played together, when we were in the same building, we really tried to stay away from the shift changes, both pit and
strength. Okay. On a kind of different topic, you mentioned that all serious players dislike CSMs. Can you share your view on them in today's and even tomorrow's casino environment?
From the casino standpoint, they're fantastic. Oh. But from a serious standpoint, you know, it's just tough to... Obviously, counters can't play them, but even serious blackjack players, you know, they're serious regular players are superstitious. They don't want machines involved in their, you know, in their fate. They want the hand shuffle. They want to see the shoe. They don't want anything other than that. That's why you see the high limit rooms not have shuffle machines and not have really any machinery back there a lot of times. But from a casino standpoint, especially at low limits, you know, they're going to become more prevalent for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's my instinct too. I was talking with my buddy Joe, who's, you know, made seven figures as a card counter. We're really just talking about like, where do we see this going? And kind of the thought was, over the years, the low limit tables are going to get worse, but you know, it's hard to picture CSMs taking over, you know, the more serious gamblers are just not going to put up with them, at least in the US.
I don't think any minimum above $15 is in danger of getting a CSM on it anytime soon.
You
talk about those $5 and $10 tables, you know, within the next few years, I could see them all being that way.
Yeah. Well, with inflation, you know, those $10 tables are now basically what, you know, or the $15 tables are now what $10 tables were 15 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And the reality is, you know, if you have a $15 or a $25, you know, hand shuffle game or even machine shuffle game, and next to it, you have a $5 or $10 continuous shuffle machine, there's going to be a market for both. You know, there's going to be a fair amount of people going to be like, no, I want to play this. I don't care about a machine. It's cheaper.
Yeah.
Same thing with the 6-to-5s. I kind of put that in the same category. You know, if you have a $5 6-to-5 table or a $10 3-to-2 table, there's plenty of people that are willing to pay $5 for 6-to-5. That's why they're becoming so prevalent. You know, everybody in our audience knows that it sucks, but you know, plenty of people out there who don't, that are willing to play it. So CSMs and 6-to-5s, it's the bane of our existence, but unfortunately it's becoming more popular and will probably continue to do so.
Yeah. It's like the table games equivalent of people playing penny slots that just have a huge house edge, you know, rather than playing.
The person who coined the phrase penny slots has got to be the smartest market person ever, right? Who can call something a penny slot that costs $4 a spin at a max bet?
That's funny. Oh man, that's a really good point. All right. So we have a common hero in Tommy Hyland, and there's a section in the book where you talk about his advice, and particularly the line that stood out to me is he says, if you purposefully make the wrong play, you're costing yourself money, and I don't do anything that costs me money. And he said, I just sit down and do what I'm there to do. If they back me off, so be it. How helpful was it to you and Mark to get, you know, Tommy's advice at that point in your guys' career?
It was monumental, because that was kind of the strategy that we'd had all along anyway. Like, we're going to hit all these places. We were a minimize expenses, maximize profits. So we didn't do any, we didn't have cover plays. We didn't have anything like that. So to have a player like that with that kind of reputation, with that kind of history, reinforce the strategy that we already had. I mean, talk about a support system. I mean, that was like, that was the rock that held us up during that time. That was crazy.
That's awesome, man. He's been such an inspiration to, you know, the Blackjack Apprenticeship community and to myself too. We're very fortunate to have someone like that. They can say, look, this is the way I've beat the game decade after decade. You know, don't get cute with this. Just do what you're there to do. Take their money. Let them make them back you off.
I can see that being extra applicable for you, since, you know, you had the bigger team like he had, and you know, he was able to do it for so long, and his team was able to do it for so long. It's pretty incredible.
It really is. So I've got a couple more questions for you. There's a quote you said, this is why you counted cards. The feeling you got knowing you were better than the game, combined with seeing piles of money all over your hotel room, was absolutely euphoric. So my question is, which that's a great quote, but do you miss your time as an AP?
I miss winning. Everybody misses winning, right? But to be honest, not really. You know, I was single when I did that. I'm married now. I have my job is more serious and at a higher level now than it was back then. The emotional highs and lows, you know, obviously the highs are great. It's counting stacks of $100 bills. There's nothing like that. But going through the losses, and even after I did go through a stint again where I played some more after I was married, and I didn't have the time. You know, if you take a big loss, it's easy to take a big loss, but it's not always easy to get it all back, you know. I just didn't have the time to put in to make sure that I could come out ahead. You know, when we were playing seriously, we were playing 10 hours a day. So I know that even at that level, you can take a big loss. So when I only have several hours a week to play, you know, I could be chasing a $2,000 loss for 2 months. You know, I don't want to do that. I'm not in the state of mind to be chasing that kind of money for, you know, my life's different now. It's just, so I don't miss it in general. Obviously the winning was great and the memories were great, but I don't wish that upon myself again.
Well, you're going to change your tune when I find that rule of 10 single deck game.
Oh, I hope you find it. Hope you find it. I would gladly come out for that.
Well, I'll be looking for it. Okay, I've got one last question. This is probably going to be the toughest to answer, but what are your favorite places to eat in Las Vegas?
That's topical. My favorite places to eat, Red Rock's got a great restaurant in there.
Is that the steakhouse?
Yard House. They've actually got several restaurants.
Yeah. But Yard House is good. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a great place to eat. The Palms has a really nice restaurant. They've done some things good with their cafe there, some remodeling.
Any other local?
Green Valley Ranch has got some great food in there.
They have a good buffet, actually. I'm not a big buffet guy, but theirs is pretty good.
Anytime you can get a nice all-you-can-eat.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Any non-casino favorites as a local?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, most of my real favorite restaurants are non-casino. I like Bonefish Grill is nice. There's a couple good sushi places around. Sushi Koma, Janka.
Ooh. There we go. Now we're cooking.
The
Sushi Koma?
Yeah, Koma. It's on Flamingo and Durango.
pretty good stuff.
All right. And what was the other sushi place you said?
Jenga. It's on Sunset and Fort Apache. Really good.
All right. Anything else?
Oh, probably. That's one of our favorite things to do is eat out. That's kind of a guilty pleasure of ours. My wife and I.
Any good breakfast places that you can still get breakfast at, 11 or 12 when you're finally awake?
Yeah, Eggworks is great. Black Bear is great. I think I had a scene, I'm not even sure if it made it into the book, to be honest, where I was sitting with Ken Cho at
Black Bear Diner after an all-night bender. It's some of our favorite restaurants.
Nice. All right. So we got Eggworks, Black Bear Diner, if you want breakfast, Sushi Koma and Jenga if you want sushi, Bonefish Grill, and then some casinos, but we'll probably stick to the non-casino places. Anything that you're thinking of now that people have to know?
As far as?
Well, I was thinking food, but actually as far as anything.
I think we kind of covered a lot of it.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being on here. I mean, yeah, nothing else you want to let people know, or where can people find your book?
It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. You can get it on the Las Vegas Advisor or Huntington Press website.
Nice.
Just ask that if you
where do you want people to buy it?
For me personally,
do you get more money if people buy it on Huntington Press's website?
No, the royalties are the same no matter where you buy them.
All right.
As long as people get it in their laps and they like it, I'm fine. Awesome. Wherever they want to buy it. All I ask is that if you do like it, head over to Amazon and leave a review. Those are super, super helpful in visibility and all that stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say that same thing. I know that that's a really big deal for book ratings and reviews. If you guys have read his book, head over to Amazon and leave a rating and a review, especially if you can do it as a verified purchaser. Okay. That's going to be really, really helpful and get that sales rank up on Amazon. I'll put a link below below the podcast so people can just get a direct link to Amazon to buy the Blackjack Insiders. And where can people, you like do Twitter or anything like that?
I don't do Twitter. I probably should, but I don't. I do Facebook at Andrew Yule, writer, and I do Instagram at Andrew Yule too, easily.
Awesome. Awesome. People can find you there if they have follow-up questions. And are you still going to be writing for LVA or
yeah, with an Edge blog or anything? I still do the question of the day feature. I still am involved with that. I'm thinking about getting the Gambling with an Edge blog back up, but no exact dates or anything on that.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I know you're working on your first fiction book, so I'll let you get back to that. Thank you so much for sharing about your book and about your experience from the casino side of things. It's been cool, and I'm sure people are getting a lot of good input from you. So thank you.
Absolutely. It's been a blast talking to you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. You guys can find his book in the notes below, and otherwise, we'll catch you next time.